Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Folt, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is John Perkins, who reads from and discusses the new paperback edition of his internationally best-selling book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, published by Penguin. In the weeks to come, we have Rick Riley, Nando Parado, Augustine Burroughs, Madeline Albright, Elizabeth Strout, Elizabeth Berg, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
Good evening. Good evening, everyone. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it is my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for supporting independent bookselling. An economic hitman, or EHM as they refer to themselves, is a highly paid professional who cheats countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars. EHMs are responsible for some of the most devastating and explosive political situations in our headlines. Yet most of us within this room had probably never heard of them before a certain best-selling book hit the shelves. With Confessions of an Economic Hitman, John Perkins, one of the most successful EHMs ever, tells us all, revealing the shadows of this world of intrigue. John Perkins worked for the international consulting firm Charles T. Main, Inc. from 1971 to 1981, where he held the titles of chief economist and manager of economics and regional planning, but in reality was an economic hitman. He is founder and CEO of Independent Power Systems, Inc., an energy company committed to producing electricity with environmentally beneficial technologies. He served as consultant to the World Bank, UN, and numerous Fortune 500 companies. A graduate of Boston University's School of Business Administration, he is also the author of other books, including Shapeshifting, The World as You Dream It, and Psychonavigation. Currently, John writes and teaches about achieving peace and prosperity. He's the founder of the nonprofit organization Dream Change, which can be reached through dreamchange.org. We are delighted that he has come to the Tattered Cover to discuss Confessions of an Economic Hitman, the new paperback edition, which includes new material, complete with a controversial epilogue. We are delighted to say it's been on the bestseller list for over 33 weeks now. Please give a warm welcome to John Perkins.
Thank you, Christine. Thanks. It's great to be in such an incredible independent bookstore. And thank you all for being here tonight for the bookstore and so we can all chat together tonight. I really, really appreciate it. It's wonderful being in Colorado. I haven't been here in many years, and I feel very welcomed in Boulder last night and here today. Thanks. tonight... I guess it would be fair to say what I'd like to talk about is the history of the world during my lifetime, which is essentially the history of the world since World War II up until today, until now. And, somebody's being called. The call of history. And I'll keep it fairly short because we have limited time tonight. I'll probably talk for half an hour, 45 minutes, which for me is short. I've got a little laryngitis because I talk so much everywhere else. And then we'll do some questions and answers, and then a book signing after that at the table here. But I think it's fair to say that the history of the world during this period since World War II can really be described, in my opinion, in four different categories. And those are, number one, that during this time, we've managed to create the world's first truly global empire. And this is an empire that was built primarily without the military for the first time, but instead through economics. Therefore, it's been built primarily in secret. Most people living within the empire, the United States, for example, have no idea that we've been building this empire. And therefore, it's a real challenge, I think, to our democracy, our democratic way of life, because a democracy is dependent upon an informed electorate. And if we don't understand that we've created this empire, then we're not very informed. It's hard to be an informed electorate if you don't know one of the most basic things about what's going on. Point two, this empire is run by a corporatocracy, which is a group of people who are in control of our largest businesses, our corporations, and through them, our government and many other governments around the world. There's no single emperor or king, despite what some of you Democrats may believe. This corporatocracy, instead we have this corporatocracy, which basically plays the role of a king or an emperor, but it's always there. It really doesn't matter whether we have a Democrat or a Republican in the White House or in Congress as far as this building of empire is concerned. The corporatocracy is in control. And at the very top, in fact, they're one and the same people. Those who run our biggest corporations are the ones who become Secretary of State, Secretary of Treasury, even Vice President and President, and then they go back to work for the corporations. And the corporatocracy and this empire, today we find that less than 5% of the world's population, us, are consuming over 25% of the world's resources, which, when you think about it, is a failed model. That cannot continue, and it certainly can't be held out as a model for Africa or India or China or South America or anywhere else. It's a model that is bound to collapse at some point. The third point here is that during this period in history, we've managed to subjugate and ignore and essentially tear down all the principles that I grew up to believe are what make America great. We've basically gone against those principles. We've managed to create a world today where over half the population on this planet lives on less than $2 a day, which isn't enough to provide the basic amenities in most countries. These people, many of them are living lives that are worse than the slaves on the pre-Civil War plantations. And I don't mean to take anything away from the terrible suffering of those slaves, but they at least were given free room and board for themselves and their families and whatever medical service was available in their communities. The plantation owners recognized that their economic well-being depended on the well-being of these slaves. Today, we can buy shirts, pants, and shoes that are made in sweatshops where people make wages that do not give them the ability to provide room and board for themselves and their families. And when they get sick, they get thrown out on the street and replaced by someone else. And we need to keep that in mind when we do our shopping. Don't buy sweatshop goods, please. So those are the first three points, which I think I would classify definitely as the bad news. We've created this global empire. It's been done through a corporatocracy, and we've gone against all our principles. The fourth point is the good news, and it's the one I'd really like us to focus on tonight. The good news is that today we find ourselves living in a very small world, one community. We know it's a very tiny planet that we're living upon. In the old days of empire building, the Spanish conquistadors did not have to worry about the Incas attacking Madrid. The British and the French didn't worry about their Asian and African colonies attacking London and Paris. Today we know we're very, very vulnerable. We live in a very small world. We also know, although many of us may not really admit to it or recognize it, but we know, I know, that my 23-year-old daughter, Jessica, cannot have children and expect them to grow up in a stable, peaceful, and sustainable world unless every single child on this planet, in Nigeria, in the Philippines, in Bolivia, also has the expectation of growing up in a stable, sustainable, and peaceful world. That's a fact. I think this is the good news, that we know we live on a small planet. We know that we're all very interrelated. And the other aspect of that is we also know that we have all the resources necessary to make this a better place for everyone. The resources are there. They just need to be handled differently. 24,000 people, 24,000 people will die today from hunger. 24,000 people died yesterday and will die tomorrow from hunger. And that's because of the systems that we've set up. It's not because the resources are not there. So the important thing for us is to look at this good news. Be committed to creating a future that recognizes how interrelated we all are, that your children and grandchildren cannot have a good life unless every child on this planet has a good life. It's just not going to happen. The violence of Iraq and 9/11 are just the first shots across the bow unless we commit to changing. So tonight, my expectation is that we will all leave here tonight committed to changing this and seeing a way to do it. Together, we, you and I, can create a better world, and we must do this. It's imperative that we do so. Before I move on with how we can do that, I'm sure some of you haven't read the book and are asking yourselves, but what is an economic hitman? What do you guys do? We do a lot of different things, but the short version is that we will identify a developing country that has resources our corporations covet, like oil. And we arrange a huge loan to that country, but the money doesn't go to the country for the most part. It goes to some of our big corporations, like the Halliburtons, the Bechtels, General Electric, you know the names, all the generals, General Dynamic, General Motors, General Electric. And these companies then build big infrastructure projects in that country, power plants, industrial parks, highways, things that serve the very rich but usually don't help the majority of the people, the poor at all. They're not connected to the electric grid, they don't drive cars, and they can't get jobs in the factories because they're not skilled enough, except in sweatshops where they'd be better off not working in the long run. So most of the money goes to our corporations. The country's left holding a huge debt, and at some point we economic hitmen go back to the country and we say, look, you know, you owe us a lot of money. You can't pay your debts, so give us a pound of flesh. Sell your oil real cheap to our oil companies, or vote with us on the next critical UN vote, or send troops in support of ours to someplace in the world, like Iraq. And in that way, we've created this empire and done it pretty much secretly. Most people aren't aware that it's been going on. When you send your men and women off to conquer other lands, like the Spaniards did, and the Germans, and the French, and the British, everybody knows that you're doing this. But when you do it the way we've done it, a lot of people are not aware of it. When we fail, the economic hitman, which doesn't happen too often, but when we fail, what we call the jackals step in. And these are men who are there to overthrow governments or assassinate their leaders. And I talk a lot about this in the book and give some pretty specific examples. For instance, in Panama, Omar Torrijos, the president of Panama, I talk a lot about him. I liked Omar. He was very dedicated to his poor people, and I was sent down to bring him around. I couldn't do it. He wouldn't buy into our system. And I respected him for that, and yet I knew that if I couldn't bring him around, and the more I got to like him, the more concerned I became, because I knew that if I couldn't bring him around, something dire was likely to happen to him. And in fact, he died in a fiery plane crash, which there's no question in my mind was a CIA orchestrated assassination. A lot of evidence pointing toward that. That's an example of a failure on my part. When economic hitmen fail, the jackals step in. In the few instances when both the economic hitmen and the jackals fail, the military comes in, and only then does the military come in. Iraq is such an example. And to talk about Iraq, we should really start with Saudi Arabia. And some of you are old enough to, like me, to remember the 1970s when OPEC embargoed oil in this country. They didn't like our policies in Israel, shut off the oil supply. We had cars lined up at the gas stations. We were afraid we were going to have another depression. The U.S. Treasury Department came to me and some other economic hitmen and said, we can never allow this to happen again. Come up with a plan. We knew that any such plan revolved around Saudi Arabia because it has more oil than anyone else. and the house of Saud was corrupt. So to make a long story short, and the long story is in the book, but the short version is that we struck a deal with the house of Saud whereby they would return the money they made selling oil around the world to the United States, investing it in U.S. government securities. The interest from those securities would be used by the Treasury Department to hire U.S. corporations to westernize Saudi Arabia, build desalinization plants, petrochemical complexes, entire cities out of the desert. And in fact, that interest and those projects have amounted to trillions of dollars since the mid-70s. The House of Saud would also agree, and this is very, very important, given what's going on in Iran today, which is much more about oil and dollars than it is about nuclear warfare, incidentally, and also what's going on in Venezuela. The House of Saud agreed never, never to buy oil, to sell oil for anything other than dollars, which put the dollar in a very strong position because they control the oil prices, and therefore everybody in OPEC had to agree to buy oil for only dollars. Iran today is selling oil for euros, although at this point it's not really happening, but they're offering to do that. Venezuela has said they will join too, which would hurt the corporatocracy extensively. In any case, the deal was they'd reinvest their petrodollars in U.S. government securities, only sell oil for dollars, keep the price of oil within limits acceptable to our oil companies, not necessarily to you and me, but to our oil companies. You can imagine they're pretty happy about the price of oil today and making record profits, despite what they may tell you. And and we would agree that we would keep the House of Saud in power as long as they maintain their part of these agreements. It was a very, very important success story for me and the other economic hitmen involved. This was a huge success. It changed the world in the early 70s. There's no question about it. And it's been maintained up until today. It's still in effect. There's been blowback. Osama bin Laden's one of those blowbacks. A lot of Muslims, a lot of Arabs hate the fact that Saudi Arabia is now very, very westernized. McDonald's and all the other accoutrements of Western culture. But it was successful from our standpoint, and we decided that Saddam Hussein should have the same opportunity to buy a similar deal. Now, our history in Iraq goes back a long time. Some of you may be aware that in the early 60s, there was a president of Iraq, his name was Qassem. He had a novel idea. He said, Iraqi oil ought to benefit the Iraqi people. Imagine that. We didn't like that very much. And so we sent in a hit team to take him out, assassination squad. It was led by an Iraqi high school senior who failed, got wounded in the process. That senior's name was Saddam Hussein. Because he didn't take out this president of Iraq, the CIA moved in directly and had Qassem publicly executed on Iraqi television. Installed Saddam's cousin as president, Saddam as vice president, head of security. Saddam eventually became president, and our relationship with him goes back a long time. In the 80s, we decided he should have a similar deal to the one we'd struck with Saudi Arabia, but he didn't buy. So we sent in the jackals, but they couldn't take him out. His security was very good, and he had a number of look-alike doubles. You know, the best way to get to a president, if you want to assassinate him, is through his security guards. It's sometimes the only way. That's how we got to Omar Torrijos. The security guard handed him a tape recorder with a bomb in it as he was getting on his plane. He didn't know there was a bomb in it. If you can buy out the security officers, then you can get to the president. In the case of Iraq, that was a little problematic because the security officers didn't know who they were guarding. If you're a security officer, you don't want to take a bribe and then kill the wrong guy. Your life and your family isn't worth too much after that. So the jackals couldn't take him out, so we sent in the military in 91. Now, we could have taken out Saddam at that time, but we didn't want to. He was the kind of guy the corporatocracy likes. A strong man, keeps his population under control, keeps the Kurds under control, keeps the Iranians in their borders. We figured that by taking out his military, we'd chastised him sufficiently that in the 90s he'd buy our deal. The economic hitmen went back in, but he didn't buy. The jackals couldn't take him out again, so we sent the military in again. So those are the three scenarios. Usually we're successful as economic hitmen, as we were in Saudi Arabia. And the few instances when we're not, the jackals usually are, as in Panama. When they're not, then and only then do we send in the military. And I can tell you, there's a force right now assembling in Guyana, which is on the borders of Venezuela. I know individuals, jackals, who are in that force. They're there, prepared to invade Venezuela. We also have, of course, forces nearby Iran, right in Iraq, that are prepared to invade Iran, all because in both countries the economic hitmen and the jackals have failed. We mustn't let that happen. Take to the streets. Write your congresspeople. Do whatever you can. We must, you know, Venezuela is a democratically elected president, Hugo Chavez. You can think what you like of him, but he's democratically elected by a far greater majority of his population than has ever elected a president in this country during my lifetime. We mustn't go against our principles again and take this man out. And it would be absolutely foolhardy to go to war with the Iranians at this point. We've seen how successful that's been in Iraq. So I'd like now to... That's the background on economic hitmen, and there's a lot more in the book if you're interested. But I'd like now to move into where we need to go to change this. We absolutely must turn this around. And the way to do this is through the power base of the corporatocracy, that is to say, the corporations. We must change our corporations. Today, most of our corporations define as their primary objective making a very few rich people much richer. That must stop. There's an urban legend out there that says that the CEOs of corporations have a legal responsibility to maximize profit. It's an urban legend. There's no such law. If there were, they wouldn't be able to pay themselves the high salaries that they do. There is no such law. But they'd like you to believe that. We must redefine corporations to say that their main goal is to take care of their employees, not just when they're employed, but after they retire. And to take care of their customers, of course, and all of those who provide the material raw inputs that go into that corporation, whether those people live in Ethiopia or Bolivia, to take care of those people and their communities and the environment and to look out for future generations. In other words, we must ask of our corporations to be good citizens, to be good communities, to act like tribes. And there's no reason why that shouldn't happen. We must move in that direction. And I'll give you some evidence as how this can work in just a minute. But I think it's important, first of all, to understand that if you look at the world, you look at a globe of the world, a map of the world, you see lots of countries with a lot of borders, that many of which were defined by the colonial powers. But most of these countries don't really have much impact on anybody else. A few like us do, but most don't. And yet, we're constantly demanding that they be democratic and that they have transparency in government. But they really don't have a lot of importance to the world. They do to the people who live there, but not to the world in general. And that's not the geopolitics of the world today, although many of us might believe that it is. The true geopolitics could be better reflected by the same globe superimposed with great clouds that move around this world, and those are the corporations. They control the world. They run the world. Out of the 100 largest economies in the world, 41 are corporations, not governments. 47 of those are U.S.-based. These corporations are not democratic, and they're not transparent. They're run, it's what I call imperialistic capitalism. We need to change that. We need to move into a situation where we'd have what I'd call democratic capitalism, where more people are involved in the decision-making process and getting benefits from the results. And I think before we are able to see clearly how we can get the corporations to do this, we need to understand that they are extremely vulnerable, corporations are. They're totally dependent on you and me to buy everything they produce. They're dependent on us to be their employees or somehow serve them. And we must remember that at the top, every single one of these corporations has the CEO and a whole chain of command that are human beings. I know a lot of CEOs, a lot of top executives, and everyone that I know understands about Osama bin Laden and what's going on in Latin America today, and I want to talk about that a little bit too. And they're very scared for their children. Every one of them that I know is scared about the future. They don't know what to do. They're looking for us to force them to change. And when we do, amazing things happen. And there's a lot of good nonprofit organizations and others that have had tremendous success. Christina mentioned earlier that I formed a nonprofit called Dream. You can go to dreamchange.org and find out about that one. And there's a lot of others. I don't want to talk about my own tonight. What I'd like to talk about is one that I have a lot of respect for and has had tremendous impact on corporations, Rainforest Action Network, RAN. They've managed to change the policies of Boise Cascade, huge corporation, Kinko, Office Depot, Citicorp, Solomon, many other huge corporations. They've changed their policies to old growth forests and rainforests. And they've done it nonviolently and been very, very successful. Many other organizations have changed corporations. When I was a student at Boston University, I couldn't walk beside the Charles River because it was so polluted. And many rivers in this country were. Today they're not. We had species going extinct that no longer are. We were using aerosol cans that were destroying the ozone layer. That's not happening anymore. Things change, and they don't change because people at the top decide they need to change. They change because you and I demand that they change. And we've been very, very successful in many of these areas. We have not at this point tried to really change the corporate structure and their basic goals. We need to do that now, and we can do that. I have an interesting little personal story and a side story. A few years ago, Rainforest Action Network went up against a major international corporation, try to get them to change their policies toward trees. And it got very ugly, and the Rainforest Action people did what they normally do, nonviolent. They're out there with banners and pickets and boycotts and so forth. And Randy Hayes, who's the founder of RAN and also was the president at that time, and a senior vice president of this big corporation locked horns. It got pretty ugly. Well, eventually RAN won. This corporation changed its policies. And a few months later, I had the unusual good fortune of being with these two gentlemen at a conference in Santa Barbara, California. Quite a few people there, among them these two. And on Saturday night, the three of us, ended up on this mountain overlooking the Pacific. There was nearly a full moon coming up. And us three men ended up in a hot tub, naked, drinking beer. And I was a little concerned. You know, here we had these guys that have been at each other's throats, and I'm the only one in between them, and we're all drinking lots of beer and naked in this hot tub, and I'm not sure what's going to happen. But as the night wore on, the senior vice president turned to Randy and he said, "You know, you made things pretty tough on our organization, and I got to thank you for doing that." He said, "I and a bunch of other executives at our company had for a long time wanted to do things differently. We wanted to be better stewards, but we didn't dare go to our management or our stockholders and suggest changes. We were afraid we'd be fired. When you came after us, It got the attention of our management. And then we had the opportunity to insist that this company do the right thing. And that's one example, but it goes across the line. There's corporate executives out there all over the place that want to do the right thing, but they don't know how, and they don't know how to approach their boards, their stockholders. We've got to show them. We've got to tell them how to do this and move in that direction and get them to do it not just about environmental issues and civil rights issues where we've been very, very successful and gender rights issues where we've also been very successful. We need now to do it on the level of actually looking at how their managements are structured. And this is the ideal time to do it with all that's going on with WorldCom and Enron and all the other corporate scandals and what's about to break, I think, with the oil companies if we just get a few balls and go out and go after them. This is a good time to do this. And a lot of the people working in those corporations are very distressed by the way their own employers are behaving. So it's time to do that. Now, you're probably, some of you are up there saying, okay, so this is all very interesting and fine and dandy, but what about me? What can I personally do? And in the book, I give a laundry list of things that you might do. You can pick and choose from those. But the fact of the matter is that we're all very different, and we've got different talents and different passions. And although you can draw from that laundry list, you've got to follow your own passions and your own talents. I'm a speaker, a writer. If you're a teacher, a plumber, a carpenter, an executive, a lawyer, a housewife, an artist, whatever you are, you've got talents. And you've got passions. Follow those. Let them direct you. But all of us, there's certain things that all of us can and I think must do. And one of the most important is that we must become very conscious that everything we do, every action we take, it affects people all over this planet. Every time we pick up Kleenex, we need to see the tree in this Kleenex and the animals and the forest that tree came from and the people who cut the tree and those who took it to the pulp and paper plant and those who have distributed it and ask ourselves, are all of these animals and people getting a fair deal? Are they getting insurance and pensions? We need to make sure they are. We need to really be aware of the tremendous interconnection. We need to educate ourselves and others. The whole sweatshop idea. You know, we need to be willing to pay more money for our shirts and clothes so they don't come from sweatshops or don't buy them. Most of us don't need as many shirts and clothes. Here's one you're not going to like. I make a lot of enemies doing this, but we need to, when we drink water, we need to be conscious of how we drink this water. So you need to drink it like this water that I'm drinking. It's not about the way I'm about to drink it. You need to stand on your head when you drink water. This is tap water. We need to drink tap water. You know, bottled water. Don't drink water from Fiji or the Alps. Think about it. And when the bottles, and actually, on average in this country now, bottled water costs $7.50 a gallon, which is a lot more than oil. And it's going to the same kind of companies that oil. Excuse me. It's tempting. Wow. This Denver water is great. I was in Boulder last night, and your water is so much better here. If you don't like your local water, get it changed. Buy filters, whatever. If you want to drink bottled water, bottle it yourself. You know, use the same bottle over and over again. Organic foods. You know, I was in Wild Oaks today here. I have this throat thing because I've been talking too much. I had to buy something for it. And it's shocking how, organic foods that come from Australia or California aren't really organic. I mean, what enters our bodies may be organic, but it's not organic from the planet standpoint if you're using a lot of oil to get it here. I'm not saying don't do it, but I'm saying be aware when you do that, of the cost that your children and grandchildren are going to pay for this. Just, we need to all be aware of this. There's so many things we can do. Education and the way we shop, the way we live, the way we create our lives. But again, we must look within ourselves. I grew up in rural New Hampshire. I was a great fan of the American Revolution. My family goes back that long ago in New England. And I was always struck by the fact that the people who ran the revolution were very diverse. George Washington, thank God George Washington, didn't try to write. He became a pretty good soldier. It took him a few years. The learning curve was a tough one, but he became a good soldier, but he didn't try to write. Thomas Jefferson and Thomas Paine were great writers. They didn't try to lead armies, fortunately. And the people in my neck of the woods in New Hampshire, the hunters became sharpshooters, and the Gloucester fishermen became our navy. We don't all need to do the same thing. We need to do what we can do best, but we can all contribute to this. And if you're thinking it's too difficult, this is just too damn tough, the corporatocracy is too big and too powerful, that's just a cop-out. Thank God George Washington didn't say that, or Thomas Jefferson. Thank God they didn't say the British Empire is just too big, it's too tough. They stuck their heads in nooses. Every one of them was a traitor, and their wives and their children were traitors. They were terrorists. They would have been hanged if we'd lost the American Revolution. But they did the right thing. And thank God my father didn't say, Hitler? Oh, he's sticking a few million Jews in ovens and marching through Europe, but so what? How does that concern me? I'm living here in the United States. I'm safe. He didn't say that. He went to war. He did the right thing, and thank God he did. We, each of us today, must have that same courage. We must be willing to put our lives on the line for next generation if that's what it's going to take. We certainly must be willing to spend more money for our clothes or wear less of them, drive less, live different lifestyles, and we must be willing to put our lives on the line. It's a characteristic of all life forms that they prepare the way for future generations. I think we've become very selfish. My generation, I think, has become very selfish over the years. And we've defined as making the life good for our children, sending them to good colleges, or finding good spouses, helping them find good spouses. But we've forgotten that they can't have good lives, they and their kids, unless everybody has a good life. We must see that. We must not cop out. We, each of us, must go out there and do our part. And I'm sure we're going to do that. If you need some inspiration, this last year we celebrated the lives and deaths of people who were very inspiring, I think. I didn't know growing up in rural New Hampshire that African Americans in many parts of this country had to ride on the back of the bus until Rosa Parks showed me. And Martin Luther King and Coretta King taught the world a great deal about civil rights, not just us, but they helped end apartheid in Africa. Amazing people out there. Eugene McCarthy, who also died this last year, brought down one of the most powerful presidents in the history of the United States, Lyndon Johnson, and helped end the war. When I grew up in New Hampshire, we used to spray DDT on poison ivy until Rachel Carson, who wrote Silent Spring, taught us that that DDT was killing our fish and our birds. So now we spend most of the spring itching. Thank you, Rachel Carson. But the birds and the bees are flourishing, and the birds and the bees, yes, and the fish too. People do amazing things. I often think of my third grade teacher and several other teachers who had tremendous influence on our lives. Sometimes we don't realize how we're impacting people, but we all can do that. We all must get out there and do the right thing. Some of you are aware that I've written other books on indigenous people and shamans, and one of the ways that these people create change in their lives is through a visualization process. I'd like to just take a few minutes to go through one of those with you. This may be a little unusual in this bookstore, I don't know, but so if you could just for a moment, I'll walk you through this, it'll be real easy. If you could just relax, close your eyes, maybe put your feet flat on the floor, take a couple of deep breaths, and take a look at this planet that we live on as though you were looking from outer space. Beautiful blue-green planet. And see the United States. Superimposed on the United States is a body of an octopus. Its tentacles reach around the planet to the most remote corners, sucking up resources from around the planet. What does it feel like to be the peasant at the end of one of those tentacles? Just take a second to see what that feels like. And what does it feel like knowing that at the top of that octopus is one man who's making 500 times in salary what his average employee in the United States makes, and 10 or 20,000 times what that peasant is making? What does that feel like? And that the goal of this corporation is to make that one man and a few of his good friends very, very wealthy. And now let's reverse that for a moment and see resources, instead of being sucked up by those tentacles, flowing out those tentacles to those people around the world. Education, resources, health services, including family planning. And this corporation, this octopus, is dedicated to taking care of its employees, its customers, and those who provide the resources to it. That's its objective. What does that feel like? Let's feel that. And now let's allow this octopus to morph into just a great web of life that reaches around the entire globe. And everything's flowing in every direction, resources, ideas, compassion. We're learning from people in the Amazon about good stewardship. They're learning things from us. The resources are flowing in all directions. Compassion and love is flowing in all directions. What does this feel like to you? This is the world that we must create and can create. And now take a moment to think about what you can do, one or two or several things that you can do beginning tonight or tomorrow morning to help make this a better world. Focusing on your best friends, your family, your town, your city, your state, your country, the world, wherever you want to go with it. But look at something that you personally can do. Where's your passion? Where are your talents? And make a commitment to doing that beginning tonight, tomorrow, as soon as possible. An absolute commitment. And now when you're ready, you can open your eyes and come back in the room and feel the power of this new vision we've had and of this commitment you've made. And I'd ask you, we'll just take a second to do this, but turn to someone near you, introduce yourself if you don't know them, and share the commitment you just made. Just take a second to do that. Okay, time's just about up. Sorry to rush you through this, but the bookstore closes at 9. I'm very aware of that. I'm going to open this up to questions and answers in just a second, but before I do, I just want to talk for a minute about what's going on. Well, first, before I do that, I just wanted to say that as we were doing that visualization about the octopuses or octopi, the one sucking up the resources and the other one sending out the resources, these may seem diametrically opposed, but I rather think that they are two phases of an evolutionary process, and we must enter the second phase if we're to survive on this planet, on a planet that we recognize as a human species. And so I don't think they're diametrically opposed at all. We just need to move in that direction. And recently when I did that at one of these bookstores, somebody ran downstairs to the counter and came back, and at the end of the talk gave me this, which I think is really cute. Very short tentacles, you know. He's morphing into the web of life, or she's morphing. I just want to take a second to talk about what's going on in Latin America today, because I think it's very, very significant. 7 countries representing over 80% of the population of South America recently voted in the candidate that ran on an anti-corporatocracy ticket. Now, these are not anti-American candidates, regardless of what our press may tell us. I speak Spanish. I travel to Latin America a lot. Anybody who's done that knows that these people will welcome you with open arms. And they love what we stand for. They love our Declaration of Independence. They love our ideas of government for, of, and by the people, and the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for everyone. How many of you are not from the original 13 states? Oh. I don't know whether you actually have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I'm from New Hampshire. I know I do. But I'm willing to grant you that right, too, as long as we can agree that it also goes south of the Rio Grande, north of the Canadian border, west of the Pacific, and east of the Atlantic. I think our founding fathers saw that for the entire world. In any case, the Latin Americans love us. They love our ideals. What they hate is being exploited by our corporations. They are saying, we're not asking for your help. We just want Ecuadorian oil to benefit Ecuadorians. We want Bolivian gas to benefit Bolivians. We want the Amazon rainforest to benefit the Brazilians, and so on and so on. However, the difficulty is, and I can tell you this for a fact, that as soon as every one of these men, or in the case of Chile, a woman, was elected president, a man like me walked into that president's office and said, "Congratulations, Mr. or Ms. President. Now I just want to remind you that I can make you and your family very, very wealthy, or I can see to it you're thrown out of office or assassinated." You can say it a little more subtly than that. There may be tape recorders running, so you're careful how you say it. But these presidents are very aware of this. They know what happened to Arbenz of Guatemala and Allende of Chile and Roldos of Ecuador and Torrijos of Panama and Noriega of Panama and Lumumba and Mossadegh of Iran and on and on and on and on. They know this. They know we can and will do this. You and I must not allow it to happen. We write your newspapers, write your congressmen, call people, talk to people. Don't let it happen. Our corporations and our corporatocracy must not do this. These are all democratically elected presidents. We must stand up for what we believe in, our true principles of democracy. And I know that we tonight are prepared to do this. And it seems like a big task, but it really isn't that big. It does require courage, and it may require what we call sacrifice, spending a little bit more money, living a little bit more moderate lifestyles. Maybe we have to risk our lives at times to make this happen. But we must go out of here tonight, and I'm confident that all of us will go out of here tonight, committed to doing the right thing, the pragmatic thing, the smart thing. We must commit ourselves to understanding and to making all decisions based on the understanding that this is a very, very small planet. You know, it's like the Titanic. The Titanic didn't have enough lifeboats to go around. This ship doesn't have any lifeboats. We've got to live on this planet. It's a very small planet. We need to understand that our progeny's futures must include the futures for children all over this planet. And so I beseech you and urge you to commit to that here tonight as you walk out of here. And I also look forward to continuing to work with you to see that this happens. Thank you. Okay, tonight we're going to take the questions from this side and the answers from this side. You're in the black? Yeah, in addition to my book, can I recommend other books or websites? There's so much out there today. Barrett Kohler, for example, my hardback publisher, has a number of great books by David Corton and Jim Garrison and many others. Greg Palast writes great stuff, and he has a website. Amy Goodman, somebody's wearing Amy's hat down here. How many people have connected with Amy? Thank God for Amy Goodman. democracynow.com and tompaine.com, there's a tremendous amount of information out there that the mainstream press isn't talking about. You know, there's been so much in the last year since my book first came out, about a year and a half ago, in the movies, Syriana and Hotel Rwanda and The Constant Gardener and Munich. And it's amazing how much information is getting out there. I'm seeing a tremendous change. In the year and a half I've been on this lecture tour, it hasn't been solid all that time, but I've seen a tremendous change in attitude. So there's a lot going on. I think we're reaching that critical mass. We're very ready. I'm extremely optimistic and encouraged by what I'm seeing in places like this tonight. Yes.
I agree.
It's a good question. You know, I talk about this in the book, how from the very beginning as an economic hitman, I felt guilty. And the woman who trained me, Claudine, who is a remarkable woman, the NSA had recruited me and found a lot of weaknesses in my character that this woman could use to hook me, and she did. I think those weaknesses are the three big drugs of our culture: money, sex, and power. And who among us doesn't have at least one of those? I had all three, and I was in my early 20s. But I knew, and nothing I did was illegal. Should be illegal, but it isn't illegal. We write the laws. And in fact, I was asked to lecture at Harvard Business School and other places about what I did. I was patted on the back by Robert McNamara, president of the World Bank, lauded for what I did. So it was easy to justify what I did. As thousands and hundreds of thousands of men and women today working in these corporations and for organizations like the World Bank justify what they're doing, even though in their hearts they know it's wrong. I knew it was wrong. I did it for 10 years. I got out in 81. And I have to live with myself. I'm not in any way trying to excuse myself. But I talk in the book about how I realized, and after I was in for 10 years, I was made a partner in the firm that I worked for officially, and I was looking at becoming very wealthy before I turned 40. And I knew that if I did that, I would be trapped. And one night I was on vacation sailing in the Caribbean. I climbed up to a sugar plantation on the top of a hill in St. John Island, and I thought about the thousands of slaves that had been brought over from Africa and died building that sugar plantation. And I felt terrible about those slaves, and then I realized that I was a slaver. And in a way, we're all slavers. But I was a real slaver. And I made a commitment that I would never do that again. And when I went back to my office the first day I was back, I quit. But I didn't talk about it. I tried several times to write the book, and I contacted friends who were in the business, and I tried to get, you know, because I wanted their stories, and I got threatened and bribed, and so I didn't write the book. And then on 9/11, I was in the Amazon with people I worked with there as part of a nonprofit organization. I found a dream change. But when I came back, I went to Ground Zero, and as I stood there looking at that smoldering pit, smelling the burning flesh, it was shortly afterwards, I knew I had to write this book, because I realized that most Americans have very little understanding of what we're doing. They think foreign aid is altruistic. It isn't. Very little of it is, but not much. And this isn't to condone Osama bin Laden or mass murder, but it is to say that I realized that the American people had to know what was going on. And so I started writing the book. And this time I didn't talk to anybody. Even my wife and daughter didn't know what I was writing about. So I couldn't be bribed and threatened. And I didn't talk about it until I had it in the hands of a very good agent. And it was being mailed out to publishing houses all over the country. And at that point, having been in the business, I know the way jackals think. The last thing they want to do is attack me at that point, because the book's going to sell millions of copies. So I felt pretty safe from the bribes and the threats at that point. So that's a short. Much of the book is about my own struggles with my guilt. Not much of the book, but some of it. So I went through that for a long, long time. And I think there's many, you know, one of the reasons I wrote the book is because people all over this country are doing the same sorts of things. All of us, in a way. I mean, who amongst us doesn't use too much gas or have too many clothes or have too big a house or watch too much television? Who amongst us doesn't do something that we know we shouldn't do? And, you know, what I did was very bad. I'm not justifying it, but anyway, over on this side, yes. Yes, as I, you know, pointed out before, Evo Morales, like these other elected presidents has been visited by economic hitmen, and the one in Ecuador who visited Gutierrez was very, very effective and brought Gutierrez around. Gutierrez went against all the policies he'd run on, cut sweet deals with the oil companies, and the people of Ecuador rose up and threw him out of office. And I have a lot of Ecuadorian friends. I have three Ecuadorian godchildren, and some of my friends called me and said, you know, when you vote for a president and he goes against everything he promised to do, democracy requires that you throw him out of office. Why don't you do the same thing? And I didn't have a very good answer, except the obvious one, to say, I guess we're not a very good democracy. Thanks. I guess that's, and then we'll do book signing. So thank you very much.
That's all for tonight's Authors on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Rick Riley, Nando Parado, Augustine Burroughs, Madeline Albright, Elizabeth Strout, Elizabeth Berg, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on April 26th, 2006.